good afternoon, good evening. Welcome back to Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am your host, L. Ariel, and you can find us at musicjobspodcast.com. That's musicjobs with an S, podcast.com. Happy October. Happy almost Halloween. Hope you're all having a great fall so far, and I hope you've enjoyed the previous episodes of this podcast, all about the music industry, all about the movers and shakers and innovators in this ever-changing music business that can help us navigate the landscape and show us really how to succeed as an artist or really any other career in the business. There are so many and there are innumerable paths to get there. So really good stuff. Last week, we had the pleasure of interviewing Larissa Lamb, an award-winning singer, songwriter, producer, and entertainer of pop dance music. She's a 20-year veteran of the music industry and really the ultimate indie artist. She's performed at the Lincoln Center, the Grammy Museum, the Staples Center. She's put out 4 solo albums, and she also has created a mental health platform at loveanddiscovery.com, which is all about mental health resources. She's created 3 PSAs for Suicide Prevention Month and started the hashtag I Feel Alive. She's also a documentarian. She's launched a documentary called Finding Cleveland about early Chinese immigrants in the Mississippi during the time of segregation and the Chinese Exclusion Act. You can check that out at findingcleveland.com. This week, I interview the one and only Rob Seals. Rob is a songwriter, producer, and educator. His work in music and supporting artists go back decades, starting out with his longtime music partner, Ellis Butler, making his first record with John Alagia, record producer for John Mayer, Jason Mraz, Ben Folds, and Edwin McCain. Rob has also worked with artists like Matt Scannell of Vertical Horizon, Ali Moss, and many more, producing records and writing songs that have been featured in lots of TV, film, and documentary films, and much more. But it was his desire to support and help artists find their voice which propelled him and his wife, Ashley, to move to Los Angeles and found the internationally known Songwriting School of Los Angeles. It's a school which attracts artists and Grammy winners and pop stars and absolute beginners from around the globe to immerse themselves in the joy of writing music. You know I love my song stuff, so here's Dig With Me, a song Rob wrote with Ali Moss that was featured on Pretty Little Liars and a bunch of other TV shows. Here it is. So dig, dig with me. Let's raise this thing from the dead and breathe some life in it. Believe
Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for being here on Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job podcast. You are my first face-to-face interview.
So all right.
I hope you feel honored and, you know.
It feels real. I feel like I'm here. I feel like you're here.
We're all here. This is live.
This is live.
It's really happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're as pink in person as in all the print materials.
Thank goodness for that. It's real.
It's so real.
What I usually do is make my guests tell me all about their childhood, at least as it relates to music, because I'd love to hear about people's kind of first exposure and first influences. And I really do feel like those things are planted very early on, and then they kind of put you on a path.
I totally agree.
Yeah, so if you want to talk about that a little bit, like childhood and first records or first song or stuff like that.
Totally. I grew up in a house of very creative people. My dad was an architect who would ultimately be integral to the urban renewal of my hometown of Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Huh.
And my mom was a graphic designer who later went back to school and became a social worker. And this is hard to imagine, but her job back then was she would get a rack of clothes from like the department store and draw them on imaginary models, and these drawings would appear in the paper each week, and that was a job she was paid to do.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
That's very creative. It is.
It's like she's imagining the life that would inhabit these clothes, you know.
Yeah.
So neither of them was a musician, but they had great taste in music, and so they had this sprawling vinyl collection. And my room was upstairs, and so through the floorboards, always too loud for my taste, you know, because I was a little kid with sensitive ears. But, you know, each day you could hear, like, Chet Baker, Earth, Wind & Fire, The Beatles, Hairspray, or Jesus Christ Superstar, Bach, Mozart, just
so a super eclectic
the mix.
Like, yeah, wow.
And so, you know, I was just exposed to all kinds of music, and I didn't have any sense of genre or anything. It was just, you know, music. Mm-hmm. The house just mm-hmm. always had music kind of rumbling through it, you know?
Wow.
Yeah.
And did either of your parents play an instrument? Or
I think my dad played cello, like, as a kid, but I think he had that experience that a lot of kids have of, like, feeling like the trick pony, you know, like that the parents trot him out to do these things. So I think he pushed back against that. So neither of them was musical at all. And they're both such great visual artists that I think unconsciously, like, I used to love to draw, but I think I figured out that music was the language that was going to be mine, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So my first instrument, I went to a little public elementary school in Walker County, Georgia. And we didn't have any kind of a music program, and a family moved to town with a kid my age, and the dad was the conductor of the local symphony,
mm-hmm.
and mom was a musician. And so basically they were like, well, we're going to have a music program in this little public elementary school. And so my parents dragged me to the cafeteria one Tuesday night and said, you have to pick out an instrument. It's all, you know, orchestra instruments. And so I grabbed a trumpet. That was my first instrument. So I played the trumpet, and that was really my first introduction to any kind of formal study of music, you know, and it wasn't very rock and roll.
Did you get to pick the trumpet, or were your parents literally?
No, they were like, you can pick from any of these instruments.
Okay,
and it was like,
okay.
You know, it was a pretty limited palette, but the, you know, the obvious ones, clarinets, saxophones,
mm-hmm.
there was a snare drum. My friend John got the snare drum. so trumpet it was. That was my first introduction to music, but I wasn't in any way thinking about being a music maker. It was just sort of like, that was one of the things you did as a kid, and I was into mm-hmm. sports and all kinds of other things.
Mm-hmm.
And then a neighbor invited me to my first concert when I was probably like 10. It was the Atlanta Rhythm Section. And if you don't know that band, ARS, it's sort of like typical of that sort of Southern rock of the day, where it was sort of like part Lynyrd Skynyrd, part kind of funk. And mm-hmm. it was just an interesting mix of stuff. Mm-hmm. It wasn't really my style of music, but I just fell in love with live music. I mean, it was like going to church
yeah.
for the first time.
Yeah.
And so I immediately formed an imaginary band
mm-hmm.
where I would be lead trumpet and my best friends would be rhythm trumpet. I didn't know that wasn't a real thing, you know? The band was going to be called Lightning. And, you know, I would spend like math classes drawing album covers. But I wrote
wow.
about 3 albums. I'm using the bunny ears here.
Yeah.
Worth of material. I was about 10, 11, because I was imagining these records that we were going to have. And, you know, back then in its age of vinyl, these were going to be like the first release was going to be a double album, right? Visionary. But I didn't have any imagination that these would actually be songs that the world would hear. It was
right.
just sort of, you know, play. But what
now, can I ask, were you like literally formulating melodies in your head, or what
yeah.
was the...
Yeah, well, mainly it was, I was writing the lyrics,
uh-huh.
but I had the melodies in my head, and
wow.
I would sing them privately. I never let anybody hear these songs. I was writing all these songs. And so it's funny, you know, I would imitate things I would hear. Like, there was a lot of Beatles in the house. And so I would sort of imitate the growth of things. So there was like my early songs were just very sugar gummy. And then I you know, saw the way those groups were sort of evolving and exploring
mm-hmm.
things. So I was trying to explore things. But, I'm 10, 11. So what I'm exploring is whatever, you know.
Yeah, but still, that's like, that's a lot. Because when you think about it, you must have had a hell of an ear for you to just.
I don't know.
Because, I mean, trumpet. Like, there's like a melody, but...
Well,
you know.
I wasn't really imagining that these songs ultimately would come through the trumpet, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think I had any facility for how these songs were really going to get out in the world. I didn't start playing guitar until I was like in junior high school. I think the bigger thing for me was I realized at some level that songs were this language that was going to help me understand the world
mm-hmm.
and express all manner of things in it. And it's hilarious to remember, you know, my imaginary band Lightning or whatever, but it's also a great thing to kind of touch, because I've always known that songs were important
mm-hmm.
and songs were a language. And
mm-hmm.
even if it's just private communication, you know, you and yourself, these,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I'll still write songs that nobody will get to hear that are for me.
Right.
And then obviously you write songs that you hope a lot of people hear and will make a difference for them too,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm. So you have these ideas for this album or double album.
We don't need to stay on this topic.
Yeah, but it's interesting because, I mean, I certainly didn't have that thought.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I didn't formulate albums and like
yeah.
a whole array. It was literally like my thing was like, I want to be Madonna on stage. And it was just more the idea, the pop star totally. Idea versus this sort of like very logistic,
right.
you know, like nuts and bolts, like actual album with, you know, a variety of songs, et cetera. So, yeah. I mean, that is really interesting.
Well, yeah. And like concept album yeah. kind of stuff. Yeah,
yeah.
So then in my high school, they had like a talent show, and I went one year, like my freshman year, and these older kids that I knew were in these rock bands, and then that just opened my head up. So I'd already had this sort of church experience of first concert and mm-hmm. buying my first vinyl and that sort of thing back when that was a thing, and now it's a thing again, vinyl. Mm-hmm. But then seeing these kids that I knew up there making music, that was the most incredible thing. And so I spent the night that night with a classmate, and neither of us played guitar, but his brother played guitar, so there was a guitar in the house, and we made like a, you know, pinky swear, we're going to learn guitar and form a band. And so that began. And so in high school, we were, you know, this kind of cheesy metal, you know, this is the 80s, so this is like, we were a metal band, you know, mullets and clothes from the merry-go-round, and all covers in the beginning, uh-huh. and then we wanted our own material. And it was funny, like, you know, how dudes will do the sort of finger on the nose, not it, you know?
Right,
and
right.
so everybody kind of nodded it on who's going to write the songs, and I was last finger. And so, but privately, you know, no one knows this, but privately I've been writing songs for years at this point. So I started writing the songs, and we say, you know, we were playing like high school dances and stuff like that. And we saved up our money and went to a recording studio. And again, you know, this is a time when, like right now, you're recording on your laptop in right. Logic. You've right. got a studio right here. Yeah. You know, your phone.
Yeah.
But we pooled all our money together and got in a van and drove to South Pittsburgh, Alabama, right next to a fireworks store where there was a recording studio that the lead singer had found.
That's an unfortunate
coincidence. It's all horrifying.
That it's next to a fireworks.
Right?
I hope they had thick walls.
They had really thick walls. Or not. I don't know. But we were a metal band, so any kind of explosion
right, exactly.
was going to be perfect, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we probably could only afford like 4 hours, and the singer wanted three of them for his waily, screamy parts.
Mm-hmm.
But that was just such a thrilling thing to hear this right. thing that you had written, you know, that I'd written come back
yeah.
through the speakers
yeah,
and everything.
Yeah, that's huge.
Anyway, you want me to keep going with this saga of...
Yeah.
So when I left for college, I just had the intuition not to bring my electric guitar because I was just afraid that I would end up in a band with whoever was on my hall who played. And if I didn't sort of out myself, I could be selective about the people that I met. So I took an acoustic guitar, and I didn't really know a lot of acoustic type of music because that hadn't been what I had been up to. But that started to open my ears up to other kinds of music and, you know, still writing songs and playing and that sort of thing. And eventually I ended up in an acoustic duo. I was a student at the University of Virginia, and we played all around the East Coast. And
so how did you find this duo? Like, that's...
Yeah.
Yeah,
well,
what was that like?
The very first day of classes, you know, you buy all your books, and you can barely carry them back to your dorm room. And so halfway back to the dorm room, I plunked down on the physics field where there was a show about to begin.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like a law firm, but a group, Spidel, Goodrich, Goggin, and Lilly, these four guys, these four really tall guys with great voices, great players, got up and played a bunch of acoustic music. And so they were mixing in their originals, which were great, and covers like, you know, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young and things like that, and James Taylor, and, you know, music that I wasn't really hip to because that wasn't what I had been listening to.
Right.
And what I saw was that music is a language, and I'd become so narrow-minded about, you know, if it didn't rock, you know, that wasn't what I wanted. But I'd grown up in a house where all music was a part of the conversation, and,
yeah.
and then I just realized, oh, you play music, you write music, you make music, it's a conversation, you just have to shut up and listen and take it in. And so that just really opened my ears up and my world up, and just random sort of thing was somewhere where somebody else was playing and singing, and we just sang together and harmonized, and we just hit
it
off,
and
that was the thing. So,
and was there any formal, did you teach yourself guitar and just ramble it?
Yeah.
There was no formal training or anything?
Well, in the beginning, I was all self-taught. I had the Mel Bay chord book. I swear to you, the first time I saw the F major chord, the first position F chord, I thought it was a misprint because your first finger is supposed to cover two strings at the same time. And I was like, this is absurd. Yeah. There's no way.
Yeah.
You know? That's why they call it the F chord.
Yeah. Like,
you know?
Yeah.
And so I kind of put guitar down for a while you're learning to play like one little, two little, three little Indians in a book like this. And I was thinking, how do you get to the songs that I love from these chords?
Yeah.
But I came back to it. And then when I started learning other people's songs, you know, again, in a pre-YouTube era, you had to basically wear out the stylus on the turntable learning songs.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did. And so I was self-taught in those ways. So it was a really torturous, slow path.
Yeah.
And years later, I'll tell you, in my early 20s, I used to sit in with other bands. And I had a good ear and I was quick on my feet and a quick learner and everything. And I was sitting in with a really talented duo called Salvador Hitchcock. Salvador Hitchcock. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. But
they were a duo. And Ben Gundersheimer is now a Latin Grammy winner as a children's musician, and his partner Erica Goad. They were so talented and they had great songs and I love their music. And I just had this really humiliating moment on stage where I didn't really understand theory, and they were they were playing a catalog that I just didn't know, and I didn't have the facility to have that conversation. And so it was, you know, one of those real wound-licking kind of moments. But I resolved that night, all right, I'm going to do something about this. I'm not going to sulk or hide, you know. And so Berkeley had a summer program in Boston, and so and so I did that. I'm like 23 or whatever. And so for me, learning music theory was like moving backwards. It was like, oh, so that's why this sounds that way, or this feels that way, and that sort of thing. And so it was really illuminating.
Yeah.
And I know there's a lot of people who are afraid of learning theory. I mean, I know you're classically trained, but a lot of people are afraid of theory because they think it'll take the spontaneity and the honesty out of it. But really, it's just another language, and it allows you a window into this sort of mystery of music, and I think with real reverence. And so my experience with theory was just, it opened up a whole world to me.
So you feel like there were like these sort of like little holes.
Oh, definitely.
And then it was like, oh, that's
why that works.
Right,
now I can see how I could go further with where I am.
Yeah.
And, you know, as a side note, as somebody who also teaches people, I think that's a big part of how I conceive of the ways I want to teach someone, because I didn't learn in the logical way. I sort of learned out of necessity, but I can see the path that would have been most effective for me. And so that's how I think when I'm, you know, approaching someone and wanting to give them whatever they need, you know?
So what about in terms of your vision, especially as like 22 or 23, like, did you have a specific artist that you were kind of emulating, or a duo or something like that, that you were like, this is where they're where I want to be? Or was it just sort of, were you more kind of by feel, like, I like doing this, I like doing this?
Well, two parts to that, really. One, I never really thought that we were participating in the music industry in a true way. So our little duo got, we weren't particularly talented in the beginning, but because we were popular, just, you know, when you have college friends, when you're in college, you immediately can have a crowd. And so we were able to sort of turn that into a following once our friends graduated. And then we finally started getting good, which was a public service to everyone else who had waded through
I'm
the
sure,
other parts.
I'm you know sure what I mean? There was still a pretty decent bass level going on.
Well, we hope so. But I think the bigger thing for us was, we didn't have necessarily an imagination that let's turn this into, let's see if we can get signed or whatever. It was just sort of like, we just couldn't believe that people would pay us and feed us to play music every week, and that we could just do it all the time. It was just kind of mind-blowing. But to sidestep that for a second, you know, when I was 17, I knew that I wanted to teach and coach athletes, because I went to a high school where two really critical things happened. One, I got to run for and study under some really remarkable teachers who gave me a capacity to work for something that was bigger than me and wasn't about me, and to love something that was bigger than me. And then also, one of my very best friends was, we ran track together, and we were sitting on they had an old Sender track at our school, like a real track, but a Sender track too, and we do a lot of workouts on that. We were sitting on the ground after a workout, and he breaks the news to me, I'm afraid I'm not going to graduate because I'm failing. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the smartest people I knew. And I just had this moment right then. I just thought, man, you're not failing school. School's failing you. Mm-hmm. And that was a big part. The combination of having people who motivated me and then seeing somebody with such profound talent and vision and heart feeling like an outsider at exactly the place where he should be finding his own voice. Mm-hmm. That just gave me the sense that what I wanted to do with my life was be in a position to equip people with the skills to get at the heart of who they are, mm-hmm. and get it across as powerfully as possible. So I always knew I wanted to be a teacher. Mm-hmm. So music was just something that I did for love, and the fact that I was paid to do it and it was growing and we made a record and we sold and that sort of thing was really kind of fun. My partner went to law school, went to Harvard Law School. And so obviously that was going to be his day job.
Yeah, wow.
But we would still, once we figured out, we could fly him down to DC where I was living and we could play like Friday, Saturday, Sunday nights, and yeah. he could get back. And, you know, all of his classmates were dubious that he was really doing this, but he was very smart. And, you know, so I was teaching at a prep school in DC, and in your early 20s, fortunately, you don't have to sleep, you know, so teach all day and coach in the afternoons. And
so
then we play gigs.
You're doing sports. Like,
yeah,
okay.
I was a head track coach and cross-country coach at this school. And then we're playing shows and you know, traveling within a few hundred miles of that radius. So playing all up and down the Atlantic seaboard and, mm-hmm. and in Virginia and stuff like that. So anyway, point is, I didn't necessarily have a vision for the music industry. I just knew that I loved to teach and coach.
Yeah.
And I loved to make music.
Yeah.
And then I just hit a point where I realized I was serving two masters and I wasn't truly honoring either of them, that I was feeling where the ceiling was musically. And as a teacher and a coach, I was just sort of burning the candle at both ends too much. And my teams hung championship banners in the rafters of the gym, and my classes were going really well. But I just knew I'd sort of run to the end of that thing. And and I think the other thing I was kind of struggling with, this is a prep school, and there was a fairly privileged clientele. And I was thinking, well, do I want to put all my energies into this one group of people who maybe already have a lot of resources? Mm-hmm. And what else could I do that would combine my loves and also allow me to reach more people? And so I didn't know there was this sort of thing around, but I sort of dreamed up some of the lessons that I've been learning as a teacher and a coach and then as a songwriter and a musician, this sort of artist in residence kind of curriculum. Mm-hmm. And so because I was plugged into the school world, I just reached out to some people I knew at other schools and said, I have this idea, is this something you'd like to do? And so long story short, I ended up sort of touring that across the country, you know, up and down each coast and across the country for the next 6-7 years, all the while playing shows and sidemanning for other artists, and then began producing records for
other
people.
And is this in high school? This is for like public high school?
This was honestly as young as what I would call writerly age. So that could be as young as like my 5-year-old daughter, Eleanor, and senior citizens, a lot of universities and high schools and things like that. And so I started like booking tours where I would get, you know, what we call an anchor date. Basically, you know you're booked somewhere. Mm-hmm. And whether that was a club gig or a school gig or whatever it was, and sort of build a tour around it. And so then I would, you know, try to play my way out and then mix in the gigs at schools, et cetera. And so if I had enough of those, then I could pepper in, you know, pro bono work at schools that might not have the resources to bring in an artist, but could still do that sort of thing too.
And were these schools without like a music program, like the universities,
you know,
and stuff like that?
The trick was usually, my angle was usually more through either the arts department or the English department. And so I had this curriculum that I was building that was about creative process. So it wasn't always specifically music, but usually what happened is like, I'd play an assembly or whatever and teach classes and workshops. And the idea was to sort of Johnny Appleseed this sort of gospel of individual creativity, you know, just trying to get kids all over the country in touch with something, not necessarily like, hey, become a songwriter, but just that there's something inside of you that's unique, and that's your calling, and let's see if we can get access to it and give you some tools to sort of cultivate it, you know? Mm-hmm. So I did that for a number of years, and all the while building some of these other things. So like I said, I was side manning for other artists, And Sidemen work turned into a lot of record producing opportunities. And so for a while, it felt like some of these things were, again, you know, kind of pulling for my attention and pulling for my time because they seemed very different. But to me, I always saw the through line. It was always about trying to tell the truth in a meaningful, passionate way and bring out the best in someone. So whether that was as a sideman supporting an artist and just trying to make choices on my instrument that would make the songs more potent, or as a record producer, sort of that times many, right? And then when I was doing these kinds of workshops, then trying to do that with kids or whoever the right. audience was.
So, okay, but the record producing, like, you could have easily been like, I'm going to work at a coffee shop. In addition, so like record producing isn't exactly sort of like another side.
Yeah.
Like, how did you kind of fall into that?
Well, like so many things, some things you back into, some things you've walked into and you didn't realize it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was playing guitar for a lot of other people. And a lot of times with songwriters, you know, you do a songwriters in the round thing. I'm sure you've done that sort of thing. And a lot of songwriters are incredible at what they do, but then they can't really interface with anybody else playing. But that's something I love to do, hear a song for the first time and in real time, you know, jump in tastefully, not noodle all over it, you know, but support it, hopefully, right? So I was getting a lot of opportunities to do that. And meanwhile, my duo had made a record, and then I was making a solo record. And I was the quote-unquote producer, but I was working with some great engineers, and they were doing all the technical stuff, and I was I was more like an executive producer. I had a vision for the songs, but I needed somebody who could really execute all the technical things.
Mm-hmm.
But then we do these writers in the rounds, and people would see my CD that said, produced by Rob Seals, and say, oh, well, I love what you do with my songs. Would you consider producing me? And at first I was like, no, I can't do that. And then I thought, well, what is a producer? A producer doesn't have to have all the answers, but she or he needs to raise all the best questions, the hardest questions, and then be willing to fight for the best results.
Right, right.
And honor the artist and honor the song. And I thought, well, I know how to do that because as a teacher and as a coach, that was my whole mission, you know, to bring out the best in someone. So I relented and I did one and I had a thrilling experience. And of course, you learn so much and you realize all the mistakes you made or whatever and you do the best you can and then hopefully better the next time. And then I realized I was spending most of my money on studio rent and paying the engineer, and I was making a paltry sum in comparison.
Yeah.
And so I started getting interested in learning some of the tools. And so, you know, as a kid, I had one of those Porta Studio 4-track cassette recorders. So I'd made demos as a little kid.
Yeah.
And I had this 8-track thing that Roland made, the VS-880.
Mm-hmm.
It was a digital recorder.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't really gone too deep in it. I'd just been making simple demos.
Yeah.
And I was working with this kind of folky bluegrassy artist, and he's like, hey, I know you have one of those recorders. Why don't we just make the record on that? And I was like, oh, no. Like, you do not want that.
Right.
You know, but long story short, he sort of forced me into it. He wouldn't take no for an answer. He didn't really have a high bar for the sonics of things. And of course, I did. I was terrified I was going to ruin this thing for him.
Right.
But it forced me to finally learn the thing I'd really wanted to go deeper into. And sort of that leads to the next and the next. So I applied for and I won a couple of grants in the state of North Carolina, artist grants. And that was a nice chunk of change, and that allowed me to sort of build a home studio.
Wow.
And
that's so cool.
Yeah, which is fun. In fact, some of the gear in the professional studio here at the Songwriting School is gear that I bought with some of that money, which is kind of fun. So,
great. It's got a lot of history.
Yeah. But anyway, you know, it's a humbling process, as you know, as someone who makes music and makes records.
But I think that's
thrilling too.
But it's also sort of a rare breed of, and I've learned this as well, it's a rare breed of a music producer that really truly wants to showcase, manifest the artist's vision.
Yeah,
you know, there's a lot, you know, and unfortunately there could be a lot of ego involved, and they're sort of like, this is what I see for you.
Right on.
And I know a lot of artists who've had that same sort of experience where they were like, I want to be me, I don't want to be what you think I should be. Yeah. So there's sort of this like tug of war. But I love that you had the approach to record producing as you did as a teacher, as a coach, and it was all about, you know, helping the artist kind of find their true self, you know?
I hope so, yeah. An insight that I had about teaching and coaching that was really powerful for me was, you know, when you're the teacher in a traditional school kind of setting, you're standing in between the student and the A, mm-hmm. right? You're the path, but you're also the gatekeeper, yeah. basically. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, A minus for you, B for you.
Right.
But when you're the coach, you are the path. You're the mm-hmm. way. Mm-hmm. And you are working with that athlete to try to accomplish a goal that they have or that you'll help them get to. Mm-hmm. And when I understood that distinction, it really transformed for me the kind of teaching that I wanted to be involved in. And I didn't want to be anybody's gatekeeper. I want to be the person that brings out the best in you because I believe in you and I know you can do it. Mm-hmm. And we're going to work together, you mm-hmm. know. And I used to do this drill when I was running on the track. I always try to condition physically but also condition a mental aspect at the same time. And so I would get one of my runners on my shoulder, not literally on my shoulder, like that's track speak, but like, you know, at my shoulder while we're running. And then there was a designated moment on the track where they were supposed to go by me. Mm-hmm. And as they were getting better, as we get later in the season, I would push them hard. I would push back. I wouldn't let them go by me. I wouldn't let them go by me and then let them go by me in the end. But the metaphor of that is really, really powerful one as a teacher, in that sometimes you're in a position as the guide or the quote teacher, but you recognize that the talent you're working with might be vastly superior to yours or capable of becoming that, but maybe it's in its infancy. And so to try to get the self out of the way and just really give them that feeling of momentum headed towards where they're going. Mm-hmm. So I think as a producer, I haven't made any big records for anybody, but I think we've made some really powerful records. But I think my talent is probably that first record in particular, that helping the artists begin to really figure out who they are
right.
and get that across.
Okay, so let's move to LA.
Let's move to LA. Well, that's what my wife and I decided, right? Yeah. In 2004, my talented wife, Ashley, and I moved to LA. We wanted to be in a creative town, and we sort of narrowed it to New York, Nashville, LA, and I grew up in Chattanooga, Tennessee, so Nashville didn't have quite the romance for me then.
Right.
And we sort of couldn't imagine, we both loved New York, but couldn't imagine living there, and yeah. LA seemed a great fit, and we knew a lot of creative people out here, and so it was really, really exciting. And I had a great opportunity right out of the gate. I sort of told myself, okay, I'll give you 2 years, Rob, where you can earn all your money out of town, and time in town is going to be about building relationships and writing songs and sort of planting seeds for the thing. And, you know, meanwhile, I knew I could make money on the road and doing the things I had been doing because I had the whole network of work that I had sort of brought with me. But one of my very first opportunities out here that I'm so grateful for, my friend Matt Scannell, who's the front man for a band called Vertical Horizon. Mm-hmm. They were coming off a great band. Yeah. He's a great writer and a great person. And so they were coming off a giant number one and a big record and everything. And he was on a little bit of a hiatus. And his vocal coach, Dave Stroud, who was running the Seth Riggs vocal program at the time, they did a summer camp. And he had asked Matt to teach a class. And Matt's like, oh, I'd love to do that for you, but I've never taught before. Could I do it with my buddy Rob? Mm-hmm. And now I have nearly the credits or the cachet that Matt had, but we had this great friendship, and so we dreamed up this sort of co-writing class curriculum. And it was just a thrill for me, just because we got to spend that week together really kind of hammering out what is it, what makes it work. And we had a lot of fun, and it was great, and worked with some amazing people. And then, of course, Matt wasn't trying to have more of those kind of gigs. He was trying to get his next record made. And so I just sort of slid into some opportunities that maybe my credits hadn't earned for me yet, you know. And but when you have a skill set and you have good intent and you absolutely. Earn your place in the room, then you keep your place in the room.
Right, exactly. You know? It's like not every artist went to Berkeley or Juilliard, you know what I mean? And they still seem to be okay.
Yeah. And so so some of the people I met doing that kind of work and in classes sometimes would become people I would ultimately work with. And some of the songs and records we made got placed in TV shows and that sort of thing. And
cool.
So that sort of moved that along. So I had a bunch of songs in film and TV.
Great. And this is in like the mid to late 2000s?
Into the teens up to current.
So Sync kind of just really getting more indie, I'm trying to think.
It already had been,
yeah.
And got to write a few songs with a wonderful artist and writer named Allie Moss, and mm-hmm. Allie is in Ingrid Michaelson's band.
Yeah.
Allie was in a class that I taught, and she had this great idea for a song that she hadn't finished. And it was the last day, and we were in the cafeteria, and I was like, hey, how's that song coming? Did you ever finish it? She's like, no, I'm totally stuck. And when there was like supposed to be like an end performance in like an hour and a half, and I was like, well, what are you doing right now? And she's
oh,
like,
oh, wow.
So we went to a classroom and banged it out, and it was a song called Prisoner of Hope, mm-hmm. and it ended up being on her record. And we wrote a bunch of other songs, and a lot of those got synced to like Pretty Little Liars and shows like that.
Excellent.
Which was fun.
That's so cool.
And yeah, and she's great.
Nice. Now let's talk about Brick and Mortar.
Brick and Mortar.
Yeah, which is the Songwriting School of Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Internationally known.
Wow.
So did you kind of know this? I keep thinking of like Field of Dreams. You know, if you build it, they will come.
It, yeah. They'll come. Don't make me cry. You know, a lot of what has happened in my life that's been significant is I've done a lot of things to build momentum, but then it takes somebody else to just touch it with a finger to mm-hmm. give me that last little push.
Yeah.
And so I had been doing these workshops and really enjoying them, but it wasn't the main thing I was doing. The main thing I was doing was songs and records and stuff. And my wife, Ashley, just said one day, hey, instead of waiting for somebody to invite you to do one of those things, why don't you just like start a class of your own? And mm-hmm. so I thought, oh yeah, I'll start a class. And I thought about that idea for a while, and I was dreaming up what that would entail. And meanwhile, it had just been striking me constantly in LA that if you could fly over LA and peel the rooftops back, you would just see all these incredible creative people busy inventing and reinventing the wheel all over town. And mm-hmm. you know, it seemed like every week we were just driving from one creative person's spot to the next, to the yeah. studio, to the next, and yeah. I just thought, God, what would happen if you just could run a flag up somewhere that said creative people are welcome here, and mm-hmm. some would know that they would come to learn, and some would yep. come to teach, and some would come to just speak once or give something, and
yep.
some would come to network,
yeah.
and wouldn't that be an amazing creative community? And what if that was a community where people felt really pushed to do their very best,
yeah.
and it was positive and encouraging in those ways? And so the Songwriting School of Los Angeles was basically born of that dream, and then it took a couple more years before all the logistics were in place in the spot and everything. And so we opened our doors in the spring of 2009.
Oh, that's so great.
And then that's enabled me to meet people like you, which mm-hmm. is, you know, really mm-hmm. thrilling. And I think the creative community here is just so inspiring to me. That's my favorite part, the people.
Yeah, it keeps growing and growing. I mean, I still remember the day, like, I called.
Do you?
You know, it was 2011, and I'd had, like, a pseudo-nervous breakdown because
right
I was
on.
At that point where, as you know, my history with the whole classical training, and I'd really just suppressed the music thing for so many
yeah.
years and just
yeah.
never felt worthy. Mm-hmm. And I literally had this breakdown, very dramatic. And the very next day I called.
Wow.
I like literally Googled like songwriting, Los Angeles. And
that's beautiful though. Right?
Yeah. And so the school came up and I called and you picked up the freaking phone. And
nice.
You were like, hey. And you literally talked. It was unbelievable. You talked to me for like 30, 40 minutes. You were like, tell me about how you started in music. Tell mm-hmm. me all about, you know, your background and how, you know, what did you learn when you were growing up? Kind of what we're doing now. And it was literally like being in a desert and somebody just offered me like a really large Gatorade. Because I love Gatorade.
That's
like
so nice.
The blue Gatorade.
The blue Gatorade,
favorite,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I literally from that, I was like, what can I sign up for? And you're like, how about the Roots?
Yeah.
And I was like, done, do it. And I think I've literally taken every class here since
well,
then.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. But do you want to just
yeah.
a plug for the Roots? Because it's such, I think, a transformative, incredible, for all different artists. I mean, I remember the class that I was in, there was visual artists mm-hmm. and graphic designers and dancers. And I mean, there's like this whole
yeah.
sort of creative community that's attracted to this course.
I appreciate you saying all that. It's thrilling to me, and it's such a humbling honor when somebody like you who has a lot, both skills and also things you're trying to work through, to entrust someone else to help them do that. And like, look at you now, you make your own records. I mean, how far is this from the classical music? And yet not, right? Ideally, we carry those things with us. Mm-hmm. We just find a way to contextualize them that are believable and true and now, you know?
Yeah.
So in the Roots, I appreciate you saying that. The Roots class is a class that I teach, and it's a class that in some ways is a big aspect of my life's work, because a lot of the exercises are things that I created and developed for myself and for others to try to address creative challenges. Mm-hmm. And then as I've had the opportunity to work with so many different people of so many different genres and skill levels, fine tune them. And like a great song, I think, I keep discovering new things about it. I keep figuring things out about the way it connects, and it deepens for me, which is pretty thrilling. And so I never get tired of it. And I've been really humbled. One of my favorite songwriters took the class, a Grammy and Oscar nominated songwriter, the drummer for one of my favorite bands.
So cool.
OK Go, and the lead guitar player for Megadeth. And then people have written some of my favorite movies. And, you know, in other words, creative people who, no matter what their, quote, success, are hungry to grow as creative people in the conversation of songs or whatever it is. Yeah. So anyway, it's thrilling.
Yeah, I mean, it is a game changer, and that's kind of how I've pitched it to other people. Well, and I know I'm not alone in that assessment. So
thank you.
And I've taken up too much of your time, but if you want to just tell me maybe just a little bit of what's coming down the pipe for the school and big plans and that type of thing.
Well, I don't know how much my meandering about trumpet-based imaginary bands is going to be helpful to people. But, you know, before I say anything about the starting school, in hopes of being helpful to somebody who's listening, because I listen to a lot of podcasts, and I'm always grateful when somebody gives me the capacity to re-examine something that I might have overlooked, or the hope to rekindle something. You could always look at the path of your life and wish that you had done something different or something sooner. Wouldn't it be awesome if I were this age doing those things or whatever? But one of the things I've really learned is that all of the experiences that you're accumulating are equipping you for the moment and the person that you are right now. Mm-hmm. And some of the seemingly inconsequential things that I've done in the past have proven to be some of the most valuable things. When I got an MFA in poetry, and when I was in grad school, one of the things that I did to pay for grad school was I had an internship thing where I taught in the writing center. And the writing center was like a diagnostic place where kids who can't write a history paper or a chem lab or whatever come in panicked.
Yeah.
And you've got an hour with them.
Right.
And basically you have to sort of diagnose what's happening or not happening and figure out what you can actually do for them and what you can teach them that they can walk out with.
Yeah.
And I did that for 2 years. And then I realized that's all pre-production of songs is.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, how far can I take this particular body and how far can I help this person go for the next one?
Yeah.
And so that seemed like a lot of sunk time back then. And now I realize it was building a muscle group. So I think all of us have these kinds of things. And I think the more we can embrace all of the parts of our path, the closer we're moving to the truth of who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're talking about, you know, innovating or making a business or whatever, in the end, what I've tried to do is make a business of this sort of work of bringing out the best in myself and in others. Mm-hmm. And it's just happened to be manifest in teaching and ultimately running a school and playing with people and writing with people and producing for people. And what I tried to do in the songwriting school was put under one roof all of those ambitions so I didn't have to be on the road all the time.
Yeah.
But what I realized that I get to do in putting all that under one roof is then bring in all these other remarkable people who have other remarkable stories and talents, and it sort of adds to and feeds one another, and we make each other better, you
mm-hmm.
know?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I hope that that's somehow helpful if you're still listening
absolutely.
After all the trumpet tales, because, you know, in the Roots, I like to say, because I believe it, that what interests you will lead you to your truth.
Mm.
And so we have to get really good at knowing what really moves us and then move aggressively in that direction.
Yeah.
You know?
Just a final question. Is there any sort of plans for the school to, you know, open a second location or outreach, or I don't know, go international, or what do you? I know obviously there's a lot of classes online.
Yeah, there are. You know, most of the classes are offered in one way or another online. But yeah, we are growing in meaningful ways,
good.
And that's the ambition. And I think, you know, the I mean, my secret ambition in all this, and I guess it's not going to be a secret anymore, but my secret ambition in all this, for me personally, is that in equipping songwriters to do the very best work they can, I feel like what you're really doing is you're taking the most attentive, best listening, most expressive people and aiming them toward their own greatness. And so I'm just so excited at the ways that we can amplify positive things from this place. So that's sort of a governing principle beneath all the things we're doing. So even if it's the class is very much about the industry or digital marketing or whatever it is, you know, the hope is that what we're really doing is fortifying deserving people to go out there and make songs that are going to change people's lives, because you and I both know that's what songs do.
Absolutely. Well, I'm here for the long haul.
Me too.
Even if it's not physically, in spirit, I'm here. So thank you so much, Rob. I really appreciate you.
Thanks for having
me. I know you work like 28,000 hours and you've got a beautiful family to be with. So thank you again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Yeah. Congratulations on what you're doing.
Thank you.
So there you have it. You know, Rob is one of those people in the music industry. He's so humble and he's so modest, but I really do think he's a game changer. You know, we talk a lot during interviews about career trajectories and being on that path and making certain decisions and people that helped and supported you along the way. And I really truly believe that Rob has been that person for an innumerable number of artists, singer-songwriters in Los Angeles and certainly around the globe. So he really is truly not necessarily a household name, but again, has really had a positive impact and influence on the music today and the music industry. So really grateful that I got to interview him and share that with you. The Songwriting School of Los Angeles can be found at thesongwritingschool.com. They're on social media, Twitter as @songschool, and they're on YouTube and Instagram and all that good stuff. They also offer a bunch of classes that you can take online, actually, so you don't even have to be in Los Angeles to take classes at the Songwriting School. And again, they just have an amazing list of instructors and classes, so I urge you to go sign up and check them out, even if you're not an artist. So wrapping up episode 6, again, thank you so much for joining us. You can find us at musicjobspodcast.com, musicjobs with an S, podcast.com. We're on all the streaming platforms, Google Play and iTunes and Android and Stitcher and anywhere else there is streaming podcasts. You should probably be able to find us. I am your host, L. Ariel. You can find me and my music at lariel.com. That's lariel.com. Again, have a wonderful week wherever you are, and don't forget to keep on hustling, pursue that dream, don't give up.